BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of BDNG Meets Podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I'm the Education and Development Lead for the BDNG. So today I've got the greatest pleasure of introducing Dr. John Reid, who I was very fortunate enough to work with in Oxford a few years ago. So welcome John today to the BDNG.
Thank you, Tina, for asking me again to come join you.
It's an absolute pleasure. And for those that don't know, who haven't listened, we actually recorded already a podcast with Dr. Reid and very informative podcast on chronic spontaneous urticaria, also known as CSU. So before we start, Dr. Reid or John, as we know each other, could you just explain what is CSU?
CSU. So Tina, CSU is chronic spontaneous urticaria. It is when patients, individuals have hives, nettle rash, wheals, angioedema, so random swellings coming up for more than 6 weeks at a time. So we arbitrarily divide a spontaneous urticaria up into acute and chronic, but we're really concentrating on chronic where it's been present for more than 6 weeks. And it is actually a very common condition. It's a common condition that affects about 1% of the population at some point in people's lives. And it's underrecognized and often gets misdiagnosed as allergy, because we all expect to see with allergy to peanuts, to cats, to dogs, that sort of thing, that people present with hives. But patients with chronic spontaneous urticaria, they generally will have hives and wheals and nettle rash occurring every day, every few hours, constantly going forward. So it can be a seriously burdensome disease for them and condition. And as I said, it often gets misdiagnosed as allergy. So one of our key points always to say is just because you see a patient or one of your patients with hives or nettle rash or angioedema, don't immediately think that it's allergy. Think very carefully about the questions that you're going to ask in your history. And that will then allow you to tease out whether this is an allergic reaction, which generally just happens there and then. I ate a bit of peanut. My hives came up. It got better in 6 hours. Nothing happened after that. That is likely to be allergy, where if CSU, where random hives every day, different times of the day, first thing in the morning, during the night, that is likely to be spontaneous urticaria.
Well, that's a really good explanation. And you mentioned there, obviously, you know, splitting it into different categories of, you know, the 6 weeks and then 6 weeks and over. Can I just split the questions here? And if we look at the, you know, under 6 weeks initially, is that mainly sort of diagnosed and dealt with in primary care? And is it more the CSU that is then referred on to secondary care? Is that how it works?
I think we don't often see acute spontaneous urticaria as a consultant dermatologist or a consultant immunologist, because it usually should be settled within a few days, a couple of weeks, basically. And although allergy can account for acute urticaria, of course, where it's happening for a few days at a time or for a few weeks, that is much more likely to be acute spontaneous urticaria. And that frequently, maybe up to about 2/3, is often infection related, often to a respiratory infection or gastrointestinal infection. And that it often leads to confusion that it is allergy, but where something has gone on for several days, very unlikely to be allergy. And that, as you've said, is primarily going to be managed in primary care. But equally, chronic spontaneous urticaria, common condition. As I said, 1 in 100 people will have this condition. That's highly likely going to be managed by primary care physicians and nurses. And so you need to have an understanding of this condition. One, to make sure that you diagnose it correctly, recognize that it's not an allergy, and be able to start appropriate treatment and escalate that treatment as quickly as you can so that these patients can be managed appropriately, because with poor control, it does bring serious burden of disease.
That's really interesting. And I know in my clinical, with my clinical hat on working, you know, I'm approached quite often by nurses that are setting up sort of CSU clinics, you know, because it's sort of ranked in with the biologics, and asking for advice, you know, how to sort of escalate treatments. When is a patient necessary going to have the right treatment, you know, about antihistamines? So would you mind, John, just talking through the treatments that we actually have at the moment and what would be a good advice for nurses running these clinics?
Okay, so obviously key bit is to ensure that you've made your diagnosis correctly, but once you're happy that your patient has chronic spontaneous urticaria, need to spend some time explaining what the condition is, explain that it's not an allergy. Patients will often have been told by someone at the school gates, by another medical practitioner, that it is allergic. So you need to reassure them that it isn't and explain that. Give them relevant patient information leaflets to help support that. Once that has been done, then you need to be starting regular, long-acting, non-stating antihistamines, which is cetirizine, loratadine, or fexphenidine 180. And you need to be aiming to reassure patients that they take these on a regular basis, on a daily basis, to ensure that the symptoms are controlled. Patients often will take one antihistamine, their symptoms get better, and then they miss a day or so and the symptoms come back again. So it's important that you make sure that your patients are taking the doses on a regular basis to control things. If the hives have appeared because they've missed a dose, then, as I sometimes say, they've missed the boat, the horse has bolted, all right? So please always make sure. So if someone comes in and says the tablets are not working, one thing to ask them is, are you actually taking them regularly?
Yes. Yeah.
And then if after 2 to 4 weeks, or 1 to 2 weeks, a single dose of cetirizine, loratadine, or fexphenidine 180 is not controlling symptoms, then you would dose escalate. And generally that means that I go to twice daily, so 10 milligrams twice daily of cetirizine or loratadine, or twice daily of fexphenidine 180. And then again, a further 1 to 2 weeks, I generally just double up and go to 4 tablets a day, which is the maximum that we aim for. Okay, and again, you need to reassure patients that this is safe. It's safe to take long term. They're not going to get addicted. Their tablets are not going to lose their efficacy. But again, it's about taking the treatment regularly. And with that sort of first line of treatment of daily regular tablets and updosing, well, you should be able to control about half of the patients. And with updosing, you should be able to actually get to about 2/3, getting some improvement. With the updosing, what we generally achieve is a reduction in itch, not generally a reduction in the number of wheals. And that's generally your first line of treatment.
It's really good to explain the first line treatment, because I think as a nurse as well, we do get asked about, you know, antihistamines, and people just naturally don't like taking tablets sometimes. And I think it's really important to give that support. And that's where, you know, nurses can definitely step in and reassure patients and also document it for patients as well. It's definitely a question that I get asked an awful lot, and sometimes as well, it's, you know, the amount of tablets and just reassuring patients, you know, that this is okay.
Yes, and it's common practice across the world. We're
Absolutely.
Not talking about Tina McKenzie being rogue or anything like that, or myself.
Yeah.
This is commonly highlighted in numerous guideline practices across the world, be it the States, be it Europe, or across the world. So it's very much supported, and also supported in special groups such as children, pregnant women, and in breastfeeding as well. And the one guideline that, or there's the BAD guidelines, the British Association of Dermatology guidelines, which were updated in 2021. And then there's the World Allergy Organization ones, or YAKI ones, which got updated every 4 years. And do have a look at those, because they provide you with guidance, but also provide you with reassurance that you're doing the right thing.
Absolutely. And it's definitely worth looking at the guidelines and reassuring as well that, you know, people all over the world are taking these tablets. It's a good point to say to patients, and it's not just, you know, the clinician in front of them that's prescribing high dose or escalating doses of antihistamines. I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. And obviously we've got a patient coming in to see me We've kind of think the diagnosis is there, but we're not quite sure. You've mentioned about the questions we could ask. What about the paperwork? How do I know that this patient's having a flare over the last few weeks? Is there any specific paperwork we should be using?
Well, again, it's all history in particular. So again, we always need to be sure. And each time you see the patient, you should be making sure that you feel that you've got the diagnosis correct each time. Always be checking. And particularly, you may not have seen the patient before. So again, do always check, have a feel. In terms of monitoring, we can use a number of different patient recorded outcome measures. The gold standard is the urticaria activity score 7. It's measured on a daily basis, looking at the intensity of itch, which is scored 0 to 3, mild, moderate, and severe, and the number of hives, which is sort of 0 to 20, 20 to 50, and greater than 50. And each the patient gives themselves a score each day on the basis of that, and you then score it up to 42. So it's sort of 6 times 7 equals 42. And moderate disease is a score greater than 16, severe disease is greater than 28. What we're of course aiming for is a UAS 7 of less than 6, so well-controlled disease, or even better, the gold standard, nothing at all, 0 out of 42. And you can do that. There are paper diaries that you can use. There's even an app that you can use called the Cruise Control app. That's Cruise as in capital R, capital R, capital C, capital R, capital U, capital S, capital E. So it's Cruise Control app that you can use to help your patients monitor it. I think what I always tend to find is that patients are not always terribly good at recording their UAS 7 because it needs to be done daily. If I'm getting stereotypical, I think there are other countries where they're much better at doing this. And in the UK, I'm not sure we're terribly good. The number of excuses that I get of the dog at the paperwork, my phone has been broken, I left the phone in the car constantly. So there are other prompts that we can use that look retrospectively rather than prospectively. And the one I like using the most, as I think I've highlighted before, is the urticaria control test. Urticaria control test. It's a lovely, simple questionnaire that looks back over 4 weeks. It's 4 very simple questions and it's scored out of 16. And what we're looking for here is a high score. We're looking for a score that's greater than 12 out of 16. So poor disease, poorly controlled disease is defined as less than 12, but really severely poorly controlled disease is sort of 0 to 4. And that's a very simple to it. And the great thing about it is you can potentially read the questions out over the telephone. So it is a great questionnaire for looking at things and seeing things. And then there are other ones as well. There's the DLQI, which we commonly use in our practice. There's the chronic urticaria quality of life questionnaire, which we use in studies. But the one that you should really get into using is the UCT because it's so simple, so quick, and you can get a very quick feel for how things are going.
That's great. It's really good to reinforce the questionnaires and also to highlight that, you know, we're all guilty of not filling in the 7-day paperwork prior. Yeah, to be honest, I would be top up there as well for not doing it. So, you know, we've got to understand people have lives as well, definitely. So it's quite an exciting time, really, for CSU, I would say. It's definitely becoming out there, you know, more talked about. You know, nurses are getting interested, consultants are getting interested. And also it seems to be getting talked an awful lot more about in the conferences we all attend as well. So we do know there's some new treatments coming up. You've talked about the antihistamines and you've talked about the importance of, you know, correct diagnosis and then also escalating to our correct treatments as well. So how does the treatments escalate past the antihistamines? What's the next step?
So community-wise, at the moment, there isn't much more after high-dose antihistamines. Occasionally, you may find you get asked to start an H2 antagonist, such as nizitidine or famotidine, but the evidence for that's not very good. It's sort of more of a holding measure. Montelukast sometimes gets added in. That potentially helps patients who have got very severe disease or significant angioedema or perhaps NSAID aggravated disease, and it might be beneficial. But we have to remember that the evidence isn't terribly good, and we need to remember that when we start in that, if we're talking to our patients, we need to remind them about the low risk, but there is a risk of sleep, dream, and potentially mood disturbance, which was highlighted by the MHRA. So we always need to make sure that patients are aware of that. The key bit, if you have a patient that's not controlled by 4 antihistamines a day, is that we ensure that we arrange referral to secondary care to start our second and third line treatments, which up until about 2014-15, we were very much limited to immunosuppressants like cyclosporin. And then the sort of the first big step was anti-IgE therapy with omalizumab, which was an amazing game changer at that point. It really was brilliant because it does work exceptionally well for up to 90% of patients. So it's given every 4 weeks and it works very well. As I said, about 50% of patients respond very well and about 30 to 40% show a partial response. And we see different, what we'll, you'll be hearing more and more over the coming years is about endotypes. Not only do we hear about endotypes in CSU, you'll hear about them in atopic eczema and in psoriasis and other conditions as well. And that's where we're thinking about the pathogenic mechanism of the condition. And by understanding that and perhaps recognizing these endotypes, we can then direct and personalize treatment going forward. So in CSU, sorry to digress a little bit, but we think about autoallergic CSU, where you have autoreactive IgE antibodies causing CSU. And then we also think about autoimmune CSU, where you have antibodies against the mast cell, and that both conditions are, or both endotypes are triggering mast cell activation and histamine release in your wheals. And we know that with the autoallergic form of CSU, that that responds very quickly and very nicely to anti-IgE therapy with omalizumab. The autoimmune one does respond. Some patients do respond. It's not quite as good, and they often respond slower, but not all of the patients do, so it's not as good. And omalizumab, as I said, has been a game changer. It was an amazing game changer and has been amazing for the past 10 years, but there are significant gaps. There are a proportion of patients, as I said, about half the patients who only respond partially. And then there are about 10 or 20% of patients who don't respond at all to omalizumab. So there are these gaps in treatment. And we're at this tipping point now. We're about to start seeing some new treatments come through. And the first one that you're going to see come through is probably likely to be in the next 12 months is one called remibrutinib. And remibrutinib is a tablet treatment. So it's not a biologic, it's a small molecule. So it's going to be the first new tablet treatment for chronic spontaneous urticaria, which is likely to get its license. And what this does, it in a sense blocks the activation of the mast cells. It interferes with the intracellular signaling that occurs after a mast cell has been activated through IgE and the high affinity receptor on mast cells. And so it actually targets both of those endotypes that I talked about. It seems to be well tolerated, time will tell, but it does seem to work very well, perhaps more effectively in the autoimmune variant. And that's the first new treatment that you're likely to see. But we'll
wait. It's really exciting as well, isn't it, to have new treatments coming through, because, you know, we've learned this in the past, you know, with other skin diseases as well. It can be, you know, we're limited what we have to offer. And, you know, like you say, there's a percentage of people that maybe certain treatments won't work for. So it does make it very exciting. And like you mentioned as well about personalising medication as well. I mean, that is our future, definitely, which is really good to hear about CSU. And thank you very much for that explanation, because I think a lot of us will be hearing more and more about this, definitely, when we're attending the conferences and things, definitely. So we've mentioned treatments, we've mentioned the future, we've also got a very important day coming up for chronic spontaneous urticaria. Can you just explain a little bit about that as well?
So it's U Day or Urticaria Day, so it's an international date. It's the 1st of October every year, where we try to highlight the background of CSU to, I suppose, in a sense, it's like promote it, really. But I suppose that means raise awareness of the condition so that people are aware of it. It's not a condition that people are aware of, really. You say to people when they come in, oh, you've got chronic spontaneous urticaria, they go, oh, what? And then you tell them that 1% of the population haven't, and they go, wow. So it is very under-recognised. If you say to people, you've got eczema, you've got psoriasis, people have heard of that. But people haven't heard of chronic spontaneous urticaria, which is really unusual. As I was saying to you, I think a little bit of it is lack of maybe social media presence, maybe the lack of a celebrity who has this condition, really, who can highlight it. And as I was saying to you, Tina, you know, everyone wants to talk about their breast cancer journey, their prostate cancer journey, maybe their alopecia areata, but we don't have celebrities talking about their dermatological diseases and particular chronic spontaneous urticaria. So if anyone has a celebrity that they're looking after, do encourage them, because we do need someone to highlight this disease more and more.
Absolutely. So if anyone knows of a celebrity out there, if anyone comes across anything on social media, please get in touch. Definitely.
Give them a push.
And of course, we've got a major celebrity in front of us, Dr. John Reed, who does do amazing work for CSU. Definitely. And I learned from the best. I must admit that. Definitely. I was very, very lucky. So we've got this important day coming up. We need to highlight it more. I do think we're making an awful more, I would say, indent on this, because, you know, it is getting talked about and we are getting clinicians excited about CSU as well. And actually knowing what it means, because that's the big thing. Yeah. If you do say CSU, people will say, pardon, what is that? You know, so it's definitely becoming more talked about and a bit more hype, which is always good. It's always good to have the hype. Definitely. Before we leave this podcast today, Dr. Reed, is there any other key sort of notes, any other key factors you would like to say to our listeners today?
No, I think that the key thing is awareness, being aware of it as a condition, being aware that it's not an allergy. I think, as we said last year, be careful. Take your history very carefully, listen to what the patient's telling you. If they're getting symptoms every day at different times of the day, first thing in the morning, during the night, randomly, with no clear pattern, with no clear consistent trigger, then that's highly, highly, highly unlikely to be allergy. And what you're looking at is spontaneous urticaria. And it's terribly important that as the first person perhaps meeting this patient, that you don't say, oh, it must be an allergy, because if you do that, you'll be sending down the patient down the wrong avenue of investigation, the wrong avenue of treatment, and they'll be looking for causes as well. And we need to definitely avoid that, because, there's one thing we were talking about at the start. There have been a lot of burden of disease studies.
Yes.
And they all very, very similarly show that there's about a 2-year delay between the onset of symptoms and the patient getting the correct diagnosis and correct treatment. And if you're living with a condition for 2 years like that, where you're misdiagnosed, poorly treated, that's a very, very hard thing to live with. Think about yourself being bitten by mosquitoes thousands of times a day. That's what it feels like, by being pricked and burnt. Putting up with that affects your sleep, affects your social life. It really has a very, very big impact on one's social life, one's work life, and there's lots of effects of that. So we do need to make sure we get it right.
That's a really good point. Absolutely fantastic. And it is. It's the burden, isn't it? It's a psychological burden, yeah. And what comes along with that as well. And often highlighted in our, you know, eczema, psoriasis, like you've mentioned already. But when it comes to chronic spontaneous urticaria, not as much. And like you say, 1% of the population, you know, 2 years to diagnosis. That's a lot of impact on that poor patient. And confidence. You lose the confidence with your clinician, don't you? So I think it's establishing that confidence and treatments that we can offer and a proper diagnosis. So I think it's a really exciting time. We've got a new tablet coming up, which is another format as well, which is great. And I think we carry on what we're doing with the education. We need to get the education out there. We need to get a celebrity if anyone knows one. And thank you very, very much indeed, Dr. Reed, for today. Thank you.
Yeah, and happy you day.
Happy You Day. You would definitely have to promote Happy You Day. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for today.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.